Okay, now we have the fun part of Q&A. I was just kind of doing the back of an envelope. I figure that we roughly have 130-plus years of experience in the auto industry sitting here, so I hope you have some good questions for that. I'm going to take the privilege of the chair and ask the first question, then we'll throw it open to the floor. And I guess and we can take this in any particular order, whoever wants to grab at it first. But what would you argue is the greatest challenge to the continued innovation of connectivity and the car? I think we've seen some remarkable pace over the past 10 to 15 years, but is there anything that we see over the next 5 to 10 that either may slow or stave the progress that we've seen? So whoever would like to take that. Doug.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay. So what we've seen, right, is the consumer electronics product development cycle spin faster and faster and faster. And we've seen all of the younger people and middle-aged people and even people like me right now depend on smartphones, and that's a part of their lives. And we're constantly trying to connect, you know, the vehicle product development cycle with that consumer electronics. And we can't reinvent that on the vehicle. Right. We can't go ahead and displace that experience and say, hey, try a new one. And so as we see all these new operating systems on these phones, iPhone 4, et cetera, come out, it's becoming increasingly difficult to make sure that connectivity is robust and that the UI is easy to use. And I think that's a challenge because all these young folks and everybody in the room, really, now they love these phones and they don't want to put them down.
Right.
And we're trying to create that interface, and it's becoming more and more challenging. We need industry standards to help us do that.
Great. Anyone else?
You want this one? This guy. I'd like to add to what Doug said. I think he's right on that. That is a significant challenge, is matching the pace of the cell phone development with the automotive industry, even as something as simple as Bluetooth connectivity, where there is industry standards for, it's proven to be difficult. Many of our customers have difficulty pairing their phone, and there's a wide range of technical capability in our user community. Some people who are early adopters take the time to learn how to do that and can do it, and it seems quite easy to them. Other people, that's a big stretch for them to try to figure out how to pair a smartphone to the car. It's one of the reasons we chose to go with an embedded approach where we've got a device built into the car so that we could eliminate as many of those variables as possible. There certainly is an enormous space and an appropriate need for us to find ways of connecting the personal mobile device, the customer's phone, to the car, but there are some features that we fundamentally believe were best done by eliminating that risk factor.
Great. Thank you. Brian?
I'm going to add actually two areas I think are really key challenges. One is an area that has not come up today, is security. How do we keep these platforms secure in a world that is functioning by night in Asia, by day in the U.S., or some other fraction of that? So as we open the architectures in the car to more applications, that means we might desire to limit who gets access. But the reality of the situation is some of the programmers and some of the students that I work with on this campus, if they want to get in, they will. And it is only a matter of time until the box is open. Second, I think the even larger challenge to that is the change in demographics that is occurring throughout the world. So the consumer that we view today is not necessarily the consumer that we're going to be marketing to tomorrow. They're going to demand different things. They're going to bend new ways of understanding that we just don't know how to provide today.
Joe.
Yeah, I would just add also, I think the uncertainty of the regulatory environment, we hear a lot of what's happening with distracted driving and other issues and concerns that people have, and a lot of that is in flux right now. And I think, you know, it's while we're on a very fast path now of development, somebody could put a roadblock on that very quickly. With the right or with a certain kind of
mixed metaphor intended,
and
yeah.
So I think until it's a looming uncertainty that probably presents a possible barrier.
I would just add one more thing to Joe's comment, and that is, whatever happens, we have to continue to strive to make these things safe, and that's a real challenge. You know, making a phone call safe was a bit of a challenge back in the day. Making these apps like many of us talked about today, another level of challenge. But as more content comes in and more people want that and demand it, that has to constantly be balanced against the whole notion of what Brian talked about in his talk, and a number of us also touched on, is we have to find ways of delivering this in a way to keep people's hands on the wheel and their eyes on the Okay. Eyes on the road, mind on the drive, I guess, is to your point, Brian.
So I think you guys have inspired some questions already from the audience. Hiawatha, and then Doug.
Oh, hi. I'm in Boston. I have just been reading a book recently called Gadgets Betray Us that makes the point that as each of these new technologies come along, the people who are designing them don't think about security at a ground-level basis, and so it ends up getting patched on afterwards and doesn't work properly. Mr. Ryder raises an excellent point. Nobody talked about that here. When you're designing these systems, from day one, how much are you thinking about things like how do we keep people from basically hacking cars remotely? Is anyone building features into these systems to make sure that does not happen the way they did to do it with the Internet?
Hiawatha, I would like to second that in some sense here. I had a conversation 4 to 5 years ago with someone in the safety department of one of the major auto companies and told me there was no way that we were going to see hackers getting into the CAN bus of a vehicle. Yet, I don't know, 2 years later, 3 years later, you find out how to do it online.
And I just want to know, are you guys preparing for that now, today, while there's still time to do it before really bad things happen?
Yeah, I can add to that. I mean, certainly it's a challenge, and we should never rest in terms of our pursuit to make sure that we're doing everything we can to mitigate that risk. Again, I might sound like a little bit of a broken record, but one of the reasons we chose to go the enabled or the embedded route where we've got a device built into the car is because it gave us a consistent protocol for communication between the car and the cloud, whereas opposed to using the customer's device where there's an expanded variety of channels and methods that were really more the cellular network's control. By having the embedded device in the car, it allows us to define and establish that communications protocol and appropriate securities in place. I'll never profess to say that we think we're bulletproof, you know, and that's why it's important for us to be vigilant and double check and triple check and think in advance of these things to try to make sure we're ahead of the game. Completely agree.
Great, thank you. Sorry.
Yeah, speaking from the other side of the equation, from the back end of the system delivery architecture and infrastructure, we were very cognizant of that in building a service delivery infrastructure, and that it had to be very secure. There are multiple levels of security and coding, and as Barry said, protocols in communicating with the vehicle. And it's one of the reasons why, as I mentioned before, when we do mobile applications, when we do website applications and being able to invoke services, it's not something that you can do direct from your smartphone over some kind of a connection to the car. It has to go securely through the back-end infrastructure so that you maintain that same level of security.
Dark.
So, yeah, I think I there's a number of ways to skin the security cat. And at Ford, what we really did is made that security firewall within the vehicle. We actually have two different CPUs. One vehicle-facing and one consumer-facing with incredible, and we've probably spent more money in security than any other place to make sure that that breach between those two CPUs was never broken, and we strictly limit, you know, the communication between those two CPUs, so we feel we have a very secure system.
Sure.
Fundamentally, unfortunately, and I am a firm believer within the industry that we have to innovate and we have to provide connectivity and provide some of what the consumer desires. There is some nice work in the academic literature that says we are probably only capable of driving at best under many situations, let alone doing anything else on top of driving. So whether that is cognitive demand, phone calls, thought process, what I bring into the car, the grocery list, or the information we're presenting in front of it, the answer is we're probably not completely capable of doing that safely. That doesn't mean we're not going to. We demand transportation. We demand independence. We demand mobility with a lot added on. And we have to give the consumer some of that. They're demanding it, and rightfully so. But how do we really begin to understand how to minimize the demands? And I have yet to see anyone in the industry putting the level of effort required into this. There's effort there, but But understanding human behavior is much more difficult than understanding how to build new technology. Human behavior, the mind, is incredibly complex. Medicine's trying to understand attention capabilities for literally hundreds of years.
Tom?
We don't know.
I think everybody in this room is probably familiar with BMW iDrive and the criticism that we took. That, of course, used your arm resting on the center console within easy reach of a controller. The menus that you were able to go through was kind of an overload, but the principle was that you didn't have to move your arm and your fingers in order to find something. I would say that we're still not convinced the touchscreen in our car would make sense, and that's why we've been working very aggressively to make the iDrive easier and easier from our perspective.
BMWs don't have touchscreens.
Correct.
If you have questions, I'll bring the microphone to you. Please identify yourselves before you ask your question.
I'd like to add something to this before we go on just a little bit. Of course, I'm sure all of the other automakers here do similar work to what we do, that in those touchscreen navigation systems, we spend a lot of time and effort studying human factors engineering and user interface to try to make those things as simple as possible. We're adding layers of voice recognition. So again, to minimize the frequency at which you need to use the touchscreen, you can do some of the features by voice, you know, like zoom in, zoom out, things like that, again, to minimize that distraction. I'll point to our colleagues here at BMW and at GM, who I think have been leading the charge and have many products over the years that have heads-up display technology. The BMW application right now, I think is a pretty good step in the right direction. And I want to add to this some historical perspective. I got in trouble with my dad here not too long ago. I'm going to get in trouble with him again when I say this story right now. But remember, before we had navigation systems, what did we do? We got out paper maps, right? And as a kid, I can remember my dad driving through Denver, Colorado, with a paper map out on the steering wheel on Interstate 70 at 80 miles an hour, all right? And that wasn't, in my 8-year-old recollection, particularly safe. I think I had better judgment than my dad did. So we have to remember, you know, in many degrees, I think this technology has displaced, you know, an old manual solution. And, you know, some might argue might be better or worse. You know, it's constant challenge. It's constant fight. We have to work on it to make it as safe as possible. If we don't do it, humans being humans will find other ways of accomplishing the same thing.
This is the reason why women beg us to stop and ask for directions.
That's correct. And why, if we're smart, we listen.
If I could, I'd like to add to what Barry said. If everything is voice controlled, right, people have a tendency not to remember all the voice interactions. Sync has 10,000 first-level voice commands. So we have one of the most sophisticated voice engine in the world. But if you rely always on voice, people will find other ways to interface with it. I think you'll find that Ford Motor Company adheres to the telematic standards that are set by the industry, and we are the most conservative company with regard to what we'll allow you to do while you're driving. We won't let you enter addresses for navigation. The length of the lists we have are strictly limited. I think it's 6 or 8. And so you can go through and see what each of the manufacturers allow their customers to do on those screens and in those interfaces. And we are one of the most conservative, if not the most conservative, automotive manufacturer there is.
The woman up front.
All right. Hi, everyone. I'm Heidi Shea, a researcher at Forrester Research. I focus on IT security, so I'm really glad to hear all these questions about security being asked. But I'm also wondering, with all these apps and, I mean, just the power of these connected cars, collecting a lot of data about all these users, the drivers, what they're doing, where they're going, what's been thought of in terms of privacy and what's being done here for them?
I'll start. And then I can tell you, specifically from the GM and the OnStar side of the equation, we have had with OnStar, let me go back to the 15 years ago when OnStar first started, the hallmark of OnStar has been really centered around privacy. Keep in mind, in 1995 and 6, when OnStar was first being kind of invented, and the thought was, let's put a system together with GPS and the ability to communicate from a vehicle, there weren't very many GPS-based products out at the time. And one of the first kind of things that people would see when they saw a vehicle, you could press a button and someone knew where you were. It began to, you know, people are like, how do you know this, right? Now it's just second nature. Everything is location-based. But from those early days, we have spent a lot of time thinking about and making sure that we spend a more than adequate time understanding what people's needs are and balancing that with their need for privacy. And so when we, for example, locate a vehicle, we do that upon an event, a button press, maybe there's a crash if it's an unfortunate circumstance. The only time we don't do that is if there's police involved and we have to locate a stolen vehicle. But it's always done under the auspices of some controlling aspect of like a public safety official or whatever, and only with the kind of permissions that we need to invoke from a customer perspective. That's really been the hallmark, as I mentioned, and as we think about delivering new services in the future, we're always thinking about that privacy aspect because it's very important to keep that trust relationship with the customer and to just do the right thing while delivering services.
The consumer tends to have a schizophrenic personality because if you think of many of the things that they want connectivity for or living out loud in places like Facebook, yet they're concerned about privacy, but yet they want to give away privacy to be able to have access to the services. So the industry is a very interesting place to balance.
Right. As we discuss the issue, oftentimes there's a debate over who owns the information coming out of the vehicle, and does the car manufacturer own it, or does a service provider own it? And our position has largely been that the consumer owns it. The person to whom that information belongs ultimately owns it, which is why as we establish user agreements or subscription agreements or contracts with those subscribers, we're very clear about, you know, how the information will be used, and there needs to be a consent. And I think to your point, it's somewhat of a trade-off.
Right.
You can have access to all of these services and this capability, but you're giving up a certain amount of privacy.
Right.
The same way with on your smartphone, you can opt out of location-based services, but you don't necessarily get the weather exactly where
right.
you're standing. So
or the restaurant.
A bit of a trade-off, but we're all about making sure that it's very clear and that that consumer has the right to opt in or opt out to those kinds of things.
Sir.
I have a love-hate. Oh, my name's Craig Fitzgerald. I'm a freelance writer. I do some work for the Boston Globe. I have a love-hate relationship with Stitcher, and in particular, I have a dozen or so podcasts that I listen to that, I mean, I love it because it's really changed the way that I listen to radio. But my biggest frustration with it is that, you know, on a trip anywhere, I'll get kicked out of it 3-4 times. It's pretty crashy. How do you, and I think my biggest level of distraction is, you know, going through the process of then loading that up again and, you know, going through the entire process. So how do you eliminate that when a lot of the things in the car are sort of app-based? How do you make them work on a consistent basis? Do you want to move on?
If we were in Washington, we'd say next question.
Let me give a generic answer for my colleagues and say that that's the reason why they need to be properly integrated in the vehicle. I don't know what vehicle you're using in the integration, but that's why it takes a long time to get systems integrated. And it may most likely not be the fault of the vehicle that it's crashing and so forth. It's the fault of something else. So so I would direct your complaint to Stitcher.
Other questions? Steven.
Hi, I'm Mark Fitzgerald, no relation. Strategy Analytics, we're a market research firm. My question is, as automakers are part of this 4-to-5-screen world, however you determine this market, how are you differentiating yourselves? Because Verizon wants to own me, Google wants to own me, Facebook wants to own me. Through something like a terminal mode or an iPod out, when you bring that into the vehicle, how do you not lose your brand or dilute the brand of an OEM? And how do you keep me in your market, in your ecosphere?
I'll try that one. So the number of ways, and I think we all have unique user interfaces, so the interior of the car and how you access that. You know, the number of applications and how you interface, right, whether you have a best-of-breed approach or not. And obviously there's some responsibility with regard to security on that, but we think our AppLink approach, right, which is going to allow us to move quickly to different apps as they emerge, and it's agnostic with regard to OS platforms, allows us to move and not get caught in the conundrum that Tim mentioned earlier. If, you know, you didn't pick Facebook and you pick somebody else, where are you going to be in 2 years if you've integrated that into the vehicle? And so I think that, and then affordability as well. I mean, I think we all were probably in this industry 10 years ago, and we were talking about telematics, and we were talking about a hockey curve where everyone's going to adopt telematics in all of their cars, and it never happened. And it didn't happen quickly because of the affordability aspect. This stuff sounds great, right? But customers aren't willing to pay an infinite amount and a big monthly service bill to get this stuff. And so I think people that find ways to implement it affordably, when they have a great UI, and then they offer a variety of the latest services in a secure fashion, will probably differentiate.
I think, Mark, also, as not speaking as an OEM, because I'm not the OEM, but speaking on maybe a comment on behalf of Mercedes-Benz approach with Embrace, you can. There's a constant battle for share of mind and share of heart of that consumer, and one of the approaches they've taken is to move the services outside of the vehicle. So as you leave the vehicle, your smartphone application provides those Embrace services through a mobile concierge tied into the same experience. Your Send to Benz feature is now a widget on your toolbar, so you're seeing that Mercedes star when you're on your browser and you pull up a destination, you click that button that ties in with your Embrace system. I guess it's a continuing battle among all those different forces you mentioned, but they've been able to expand their presence and their relationship with the customer to different places where that customer is, keeping that Embrace brand and that service level front and center.
Steven?
Steven Zoff from MIT. I think one thing that I was really struck by in a number of the presentations was the new names that I saw as industry partners. I think that 10 years ago, I wouldn't have recognized any of those, certainly, maybe even 5 years ago. So how would you characterize the nature of the relationship with these new partners? What have you learned from them, and what have they learned from you?
Interesting comment. I would tend to agree with you. I've been doing this for a long time, and I think Doug probably had one of the more profound slides up because he showed a lot of his partners up there, and we have a large number of partners as well at GM and at OnStar. The interesting thing that I think is behind all that and the reason for that is that in this space, the expectations for this space aren't really set by the auto industry. Not really. They're set by this industry and some of the folks that you mentioned. It's not necessarily any one entity within that industry. There's a wide range of people, whether it's the Googles or the Apples or whoever, content providers. And the nature of what I think we've done, and I think I can, I'll let others speak if it's different, but we've had to reach out to those entities out there and say, tell us about what's going on in your space so we can figure out how to adapt our space to it. For a long time, and I can remember many, many years ago, too many to mention, when we were trying to figure out as an industry how to make cellular hands-free phone calls. And people started to invent custom docks for phones. You've got the new Motorola XYZ phone, we're going to have a dock. By the time we engineered the dock, the phone was in and out of the cellular store and it was gone. And so, I think probably learned collectively some pretty painful lessons through all that and decided we're going to have to take a step back and acknowledge the fact that we may be the tail on this dog, and there's some other big players in this market that we have to really work with and partner with and understand what they know about the business and learn something from them and then adapt with them. I don't know if that got to some of your question or not.
I think the key point, too, is just to kind of know our place. I'm going to combine the two questions just a little bit. I think both Doug and Tim talked about the need for us to be able to have an adaptable platform, right, so that as the hot new thing 2 years from now becomes important, we have a mechanism that allows it to be appropriately integrated into the car. That's a big challenge, right? We're all in a race to figure out who can do that best, and I think the automaker that finds a way to do that will win loyalty because it is an external ecosystem connecting to the car. That being said, we have to remember that a car is still a significant portion of the person's life. So there are some functions where there's an appropriate role and a direct relationship where we can leverage these platforms to help manage that experience better. Again, I think GM has done a lot of great things with diagnostics. We're proud of the things we're doing with diagnostics and using these tools to connect to the customer and their car and their dealer so they can simplify their life through things like service scheduling and information management.
I would just add quickly that there are, I think, three kinds of partners. There are the very enthusiastic partners that see the advantage and they want to work with you, and they're very flexible and they're very, very willing to collaborate. BlackBerry comes to mind. They're outstanding. Then there are the partners who say, well, we just don't want to spend any time and energy and resources, but I guess we have to because our customers use your car, and so they're the reluctant, but they're willing to go along. And for those partners, we provide what we call a suitcase, which is electronic vehicle. It's electronics of the vehicle entertainment system in a briefcase that we give to them and say, here, if your phone can Bluetooth connect with this, you're okay. Well, we find lots and lots and lots of trouble and problems, and we work together and get them ironed out. The problem is always with the phone. Absolutely, in our case, always with the phone. They change the software and they do something differently, and then it's not compatible. And then you have the really difficult to get to bring you on board with information, and we have to buy their product, and then we have to find the problems, and then we have to call to their attention, and then we have to hope that their executives drive our cars and are frustrated and literally get some action. And I won't mention the name of that particular company, but and so we have these three partners, and we really like the first two that are willing to go along with us, and we hope that the third one sees the light soon.
I think the intersection of these companies is driven by product and consumer need, and we saw it first when we looked at hands-free calling, the phone in the car. I think naturally the next two arenas that are driving all of us to interface with the wireless companies and the phone manufacturers is search and voice. They are building outstanding voice engines. I'm sure you guys have probably played with the Google voice engine where it translates languages. What a wonderful product to offer in the car in Europe or in Asia. And so I find that there's a lot of enthusiasm for bringing those two things together because it's something naturally you want to do when you're in the car. You're searching for things. And it's safe to interface with a voice engine and find where you want to go. And we know that if we don't offer those services, they are going to pull out the map. Mm-hmm. They are going to print something off of MapQuest and use that. And so that's where we're finding the intersection, where the product roadmaps kind of tie together.
I think we have to recognize there's a fundamental sync problem, not to step on the trademark sync, but there's a fundamental sync problem in terms of you've got the internet, consumer electronics industry working in internet time in 18 months, the auto industry doing product cycle 3 to 5 years, depending on whose literature you look at. And by the way, the consumer is now keeping that car longer than they did years ago, so we're now looking at 7 to 8 years. So you're going to be in sync for maybe 15 months and then out possibly for as long as 5 years and have gone through maybe as many as 3 cycles of consumer electronics in that time. So the industry is really, in this case, I would argue, playing catch-up. The consumer is going to be happy for a short time, and the electronics industry will keep moving, and the consumer will be waiting until their next platform. Maybe that will drive sales or not. Next questions. Doug.
I'm excited about the potential translation. I mean, certain neighborhoods would be nice to be able to translate expletives into other languages and still improve the conditions. I have a question for Tom. In your presentation, one of your slides said that one of our responsibilities is to provide a system that can be used safely, and you had scratched out will be used safely.
Right.
And I'm wondering, given that the result or potential result of failure or to be safe is injury and death, why don't you have a responsibility to provide a system that will be used safely or can only be used safely?
We use simulators with real people under real conditions to evaluate systems. We do our best to make the systems capable of being safely operated under reasonable conditions. Not everyone that drives a car is reasonable. There are reckless people, absolutely blatantly reckless people that will do things intentionally, dangerously, and so forth. So the desire for society would be to design only systems that will be, that are operated safely. But we are not there in the vehicle with the person. We cannot control the person who's under the influence of Jack Daniels, who's under the influence of a pending divorce, and all of these societal and physiological influences. So that's why I crossed out the word will, because as much as we will it to happen, as much as we want it to happen, and we strive to do that, we have a responsibility to make it safe under reasonable conditions. That's really the bottom line is there has to be some reasonableness. And a person who is driving with their teenage friends and the passenger reaches over, turns off the key, and throws the keys out the window and the steering locks, that's unreasonable. And we look for those, and I also mentioned about the trend. There had been a trend of such ridiculous circumstances with the key locking up, the steering locking up as a result of this mischief and tragedies, and the trend was recognized, and now you can't pull the key out unless it's in park. So that's kind of the evolution. We try to make it reasonably safe as possible, and then we look at the trend and see if there's something we're missing that we need to enhance and go even further.
I'm going to second some of Tom's comments there, is that we might try to strive and engineer for that perfect solution, but the consumer will find ways around that. It comes to mind a conversation I had a couple months ago with a consumer who loved his new Bluetooth system because it allowed them to text and talk at the same time. You know, if there's a will, there's a way, or there's an app that'll help you do it. So I think as an industry, the entire industry needs to look at safety in your life. None of this is really truly safe. It's how do we make it safer? How do we make it acceptable? How do we make it lower demanding within reason? And there's always that population out there that is going to find a way around because they believe they're invincible.
You know, we're a few years away from this, or maybe not as many as we think, and I don't want to create too many leading statements here, but, Google just announced the program where they're launching into Las Vegas, right? An expanded platform for their driverless car. You know, so if we've got a problem with the driver being distracted instead of their driving, perhaps we're approaching a point where one of the solutions for that is that the person in the car doesn't have to be driving. And us continuing to explore, these technologies and how they relate to cars can assist us in moving that direction.
There's a multi-million dollar elephant in the room. I was wondering, are there any attorneys in the room? Because essentially what we've been dancing around is the issue of liability. So we don't have any lawyers or would-be lawyers?
Oh, good.
Okay. So it's a clean room. We're good. No.
The automation question is interesting. And technologically, automation is possible. DARPA, through the Urban Challenge Program, demonstrated that clearly. Google has really done a lot in trying to commoditize that. Fundamentally, though, unless the driver is completely 100% out of the loop, which is fundamentally probably a little further out there than we'd all like to believe. Probably no one in this room. Yeah, call that a bus. Call that a train. And I mean the driver is no longer anywhere involved. Automation will create more problems with distraction than it solves. Automation reduces workload, and attention and fatigue become a bigger issue. The driver, who is not necessarily rational, we'd like them to be rational, says, well, I'm falling asleep, I'm inattentive, the car's in control, what am I going to do? I'm going to pull out my iPad, I'm going to pull out my phone, and is going to be incredibly engaged. And then at some point in time, the driver will have to get back involved. And the whole industry is going to leave the driver in the loop for a while from a liability perspective. They have to. So when that driver is called upon to perform a task again, they are in a very tough situation to rise the capacity in to respond safely. So it's a really catch-22. And automation has some really nice roles, but how do we help manage the driver through this in a really appropriate way? In trying to provide them, because they ultimately are the decision maker with the tools to make better decisions.
Yes, sir.
Bill Griffith, Boston.com. In my driveway, there's a 2006 and a 2004. I think I'm capable of putting in an aftermarket head unit that will have navigation, Bluetooth, and streaming. But these new systems, will they allow for any of that down the road, or are they really proprietary?
I don't know if I understand the question.
Well, maybe they won't need it. Yeah, maybe will they be capable of being upgraded as the years go along?
So with the sync system, one of the things that we're very proud of is, you know, we have USB updatability. And one of the things we've allowed to do, we've released a number of connectivity packs through that download capability through Sync My Ride that allow you to make sure that Sync connects to the latest devices that are out there. And we've had a number of software upgrades that we've delivered, and I think everybody's moving to platforms. Ours happens to be the Microsoft platform that allows you to add that kind of applications, you know, functionality downstream. As an example, with our traffic directions and information services, we actually released a software pack that for Mustangs and Fusions that were already built, you could go to Sync My Ride and download that software pack onto an existing vehicle, and you had, you know, a navigation system, which everyone here will attest is one of the most sophisticated, difficult set of software, and we allowed that upgrade onto the platform. So I think where we're going is building software platforms that are more upgradable through, you know, different operating systems, and so I think that's happening.
Doug Williams, head of engineering for Zipcar, and so we work with most of you all on your teams. You talked about the mounting and the joining and pairing, and Doug, you did as well. Do you all see, is USB or is there some, the Bluetooth pairing is a kind of a barrier? Our customers are in the high 90s for smartphone adoption. And then the universal mount, the mechanics, do you all see a direction that'll bring that together for you, or and can the group of you join together to drive that? We have not yet seen. Today we're wiring the audio jack of all your cars. That's our universal solution. We'd like to do better.
I can start. I'll start with a quick response. I think we've definitely seen some movement towards some standardization. I think what we see, and you've heard a couple of us talk about the fact that even though there's quote-unquote standards emerging like Bluetooth, there is no standard way to pair a Bluetooth phone that's really emerged. And what we find, and you heard Tom also mention, you know, the trouble we get into is the proliferation of devices like that. We're trying to keep up with them. We find that a particular sub-model of some brand of phone has got some quirk to it, and it has kind of an edge case to it that, you know, when you want to continue the conversation after you shut off the car, something happens. And so we're needing, I think, more standardization in this space. I think we'd all enjoy that very much because we probably all have fairly significant teams of people, whether they're internal or whether we're paying someone on the outside to test interoperability and manage that. In the end, I think we would definitely benefit from more standardization. And there are some bodies that I know some of us here on the panel here are jointly involved with from an automotive perspective. But again, we're not the only person under the tent, right? There's a lot of other folks that have to come to the party, whether it's cell phone manufacturers, operating system providers, wireless carriers, et cetera.
The four or five of you joined together, could you force that? Because we don't see any evidence yet that you are.
Well, we sit. I can say that, for example, we have people that are represented on Bluetooth SIG, as an example. That's a Bluetooth special interest group. There's a car connectivity consortium that's recently been formed to allow the automakers and phone manufacturers to kind of come together and talk about how we deal with some of these advanced connectivity options. I think the second one is probably a little more in its infancy. It's just getting started, just getting off the ground. It's a tough problem to solve because I think the speed at which things get introduced in the phone market is very rapid. And we have traditionally, frankly, not been as flexible as what Doug mentioned. I can put a plug in from a Chevy MyLink perspective. We're doing the exact same thing with upgradability. So if we find a need to get something enhanced, someone can bring a thumb drive out to the car and plug it in and reflash their head unit to get caught up, so to speak. And I think that's going to help facilitate some of this. I think it's still going to take some more cross-industry action to really get this problem solved.
I agree with Tim completely, and I think I know on the automotive side there's a great willingness to sit down at the table. This is where we could use your help and the regulators' help in kind of forcing that marriage. I mean, when you look at, you have a Bluetooth system and a hands-free system and it stops connecting, and we've all experienced this. This isn't a Ford or a GM or a Hyundai issue or anything else, right? It happens. And then what happens to that individual? They still have to make the call. They get down and they take their phone out. And so people wonder, you know, how Secretary LaHood or other people can help. The help we need is to force the industry to get together and create those standards, right, and force us to get at the table and create a really robust interface. And I think we're all willing to do that.
Just to combine the past two questions, one comment, thinking about upgrading older vehicles and giving them telematics capabilities and about standards, we work a lot with the Open Mobile Alliance for Device Management, which is, I mean, the parallel is software reflashes that you do on your computer. And so the OMADM provides the methodology for being able to reflash, whether it be that telematics device in the car or some other connectivity device or some other module, without doing that over the air, the same way that you download software patches over the internet. There will probably be some limit on cars if they didn't have some sort of basic capability built into them to be able to bring in new telematics systems. Those that had capability, in many cases, we find with older vehicles, as long as you have the basic connectivity, yes, you can do software patches and bring in many of the new features. Beyond that, there's a whole marketplace of, I think, aftermarket solutions for this kind of thing for vehicles. You know, there's 200 million vehicles on the road or whatever the number is that will never have telematics systems. We talk to a lot of different companies who are interested in bringing in telematics capabilities, and so they don't have the resources to be building the back ends and the service infrastructures, and that's where a company like Hughes comes in. We're working with them to perhaps connect to a device that they can find a way to get to people who want to have telematics capability but don't have a vehicle that enables it.
Question over here, Reed.
Hi. My name is Reed Cochran. I'm the executive director of SCM Community Transportation based in Somerville. We're in the business of helping people give up the car keys. I wanted to try to connect what Brian is saying with what the rest of the panel is saying. When he put the chart up there about the zones of a driver's attention when they're either inattentive or approaching a high level of distraction, what is actually in the works in the industry to give drivers feedback about how they're performing real time and intuiting when they may not be at their optimal state of mind? And then as a follow-on to that, is there anything on your minds about helping people understand that their driving capabilities are diminishing? Like, would you be able, through telematics, to provide somebody feedback saying, listen, your reflex time has slowed down quite a bit? Or, you know, even more evil, send something to somebody's child saying, your dad's slow on the brakes, you better take away the car keys. I think that is a contribution that the industry could make to safety is by helping people actually realize that they can't drive any longer.
It's a really good question, and I'm very curious to see what the industry says here. But I think the real key is how do you very softly provide that feedback? Because the large kick is not safe either. And so softly motivating people towards better behavior. And we really need to look at how we can change what's coming into the car, how the car performs, and how do we provide that feedback back, whether it is that text messaging, is that real-time alerts. And again, alerts in the car aren't really necessarily safe. Or, we've done some work in the lab looking at just ambient display of state, you know, the green, red, yellow, red metaphor. You know, green you're doing well, red you're not doing well. Will people make better decisions upon that over time? It's a real open question.
I think that discussion actually is very up to date with what's happening right now with drunk driving detection and blocking the starting of the car. On the surface, that's wonderful. It's tremendous. Let's do that. And then you come to the question of, okay, now the engineers have to develop a system that works. So you need to measure the physiology of the driver. And you need to do that in a way that is quick, very reliable, non-invasive, and. So you would say, well, we're going to measure it through the skin. We're going to measure it non-invasively, measuring the pupils and so forth. All right, it has to be very quick, has to be very reliable. Then you need to make a decision about when is it go, no go. When does the driver fail the test and not be able to start the car? Well, the legal drunk limit is 0.08. So you make it at 0.079, 0.076, 0.06, 0.05. What do you make it? Well, a car company makes it 0.04, okay? And that would be in terms of tiredness, the threshold for the warning or for taking intervention. So we make it 0.04. And then another company says, we're 0.03, we're safer than you. And then there's a crash at 0.02, and the company is sued saying, well, you could have made it 0.01. And so you get to this point where even though you might have a technology that is fast and reliable and non-invasive and all these great things, now you reach that critical point where someone has to decide, when do you take the keys away? When do you block the starting? And that's a really hard question. That's a really, really tough thing. And then you have the scenario where, as we all know, that after you drink a six-pack of beer, you're not immediately drunk because the alcohol hasn't reached your blood. So you drink the six-pack quickly. We all know students who have done that. I don't have personal experience. Maybe tequila, but not.
All in the name of science.
Right, in the name of science. And so the blood alcohol rises over time. So you not only have to test the physiology of tired and so forth at the time, blood alcohol level when starting, but you have to periodically test because as it goes up. So I think your proposal is great, and we've been thinking about all these things, and there is activity to make physiological measurements in order to react, but it brings about incredible complexity. To be reliable, to be fast, to be non-invasive. I mean, a Mormon doesn't want to be measured for blood alcohol level because they don't ever drink. So you need to minimize their inconvenience because they don't ever touch the stuff. So you have to consider all these societal things plus the technology, plus the tolerances, plus the threshold question. And that's where we run into a lot of great difficulty. I think my colleagues on the panel who have had to be deposed for lawsuits would probably agree with me by saying that doesn't matter. You were never quick enough. When there's a fatality, when there's a crash, when there's a tragedy, you were never doing it fast enough, good enough. If you're saying you're tired and you should take a coffee break, the question is, well, why didn't you say that 3 miles up the road before the crash? So, yeah, the premise of your proposal is terrific, and we all are working. I think all the whole industry is working toward getting to that point. But the obstacles toward doing it fast are all these things that we have to consider. So we're working on it, but it just takes time, and it's frustrating for us. But it's frustrating for society to say, why don't you just have something that measures blood alcohol? I can blow into something. And it can tell me I can buy it for $99 or $60. Well, we can build that in the car. Well, do you want the valet blowing into your car's mouth?
I'm going to ask a question. You don't have to identify yourselves because it'll show your age. But do you remember the first iteration of the talking car? This is like deja vu all over again. The door is ajar. What did most people do when the car started talking to them after the second time they turned the car on? Now, where's that fuse box? So, yeah, we want feedback, but yet there's been this very much a split personality with the consumer on how much feedback.
We have time for one more question.
Hi, I'm Pierre Cantor for General Motors, but I'll ask you a question as a regular consumer. You have sensors in the passenger seat that detect whether a person is sitting there for the airbag deployment. Can you use that sensor if you see someone sitting in the passenger seat? You'll be able to input an address on the navigation system while you're driving. A lot of people like me don't want to stop in the middle of the highway in order to input an address. So if you have a GM car, you call OnStar. But if you're renting a car, you usually take out your Google Map or, you know, and start inputting it.
We've thought about that, and we thought about the ways around it. So, for instance, the first thing somebody might do is they'll throw their book bag on the passenger seat. We thought about having a Bluetooth circle for proximity to see how far away, and then we imagine people leaning over or the back to enter the information from the back seat. So while we love the idea, I don't think we've thought of a way that people can't get around. But if you've thought of one, let us know.
Well, let me offer some what I think were some summary points that I heard and some that we can synthesize. We know we were talking about the driver in a generic sense, but the generic is far from a homogenous group. And so when we touched a little bit on liability around and about, you know, the traditional standard of liability is the reasonable man standard. Now that we should look at the driving population, are we now looking at the reasonable, older, smaller woman standard behind the wheel as a matter of judgment as well as design? Two, how to innovate without leaving the consumer behind has been the adage that we've been thinking about for the past few years. Given how quickly the consumer is moving with their behavior, the question is how can the auto industry keep up to the consumer in this case? Technology education, where does that begin and end? Is that a new responsibility for the dealership, or do we see a new group of new company or a new service out there in terms of how to use the technology but how to use it safely? Technology is innovating in internet time, but it's both outpacing policy, regulators, and designers. The standards that we currently use for design are based upon distraction factors that we came up with in the 1970s and 80s and really had no idea of what we'd be looking at today. Nomadic devices, we were talking about the role of the OEMs on that, but we really weren't talking about the role of the nomadic devices and their manufacturers around liability, design, and fully understanding how they're going to be used. What are the role of other stakeholders, including the retailers? I don't know if anyone from the insurance industry is here, but we're certainly thinking of you. Consumer electronics, manufacturers, telecoms, and cloud providers. Are we about to see the OEMs provide a platform, but somebody else own the space and the operation? What's next? We talked about personalized feedback. Is it also given the fact that we're seeing that the younger people, the ones who are the most in touch with the electronics in their hands, are finding the auto far less attractive than the generation before them? They're getting their licenses later. They are purchasing later. Are we going to see a time where a lot of this connectivity that we're talking about may, in fact, make Zipcar's model and other models like that far more attractive, where we don't own the car, but we prefer to own the service? And then lastly, we talked about security and we talked about privacy as outstanding issues around the technology as well as how we use it. So this just seemed to be some of the themes we talked about and how we're all trying to reach a service that is both good services that are seamless and safe. I hope you all join me in thanking our speakers, NEMBA and the United Road for sponsoring this event, and thank you very much.
Coughlin, we need to thank you as well.
I know what your schedule is like. We deeply appreciate your making time to join us.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.